Greetings and good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is November 19th, 2017. It's Sunday, sunny and much colder than it's been here in Nashville. We had a storm blow through yesterday with rain and high winds. The temperature went from the 60s to the low 40s. The leaves are now almost completely off the trees here as we approach Thanksgiving. Last Thursday, I had the occasion to sit down with an old acquaintance, Bill Terry. Bill is a city planner of distinguished reputation here in Tennessee. As you will hear, he worked for the Tennessee State Planning Office for many years and then the city of Gallatin. He is now a freelance consultant in planning and serves as the lobbyist for the Tennessee chapter of the American Planning Association. When I first came to Tennessee, I worked for the city of Gatlinburg. One of the first people I met was a fellow named Kent Gardner. Kent was the representative of the Tennessee State Planning Office to communities in Sevier County. I learned so much from him, and he never failed in being able to refer me to just the right person to assist with a grant application or some other project I was working on. I came to value the work that was done by city planners and by the Tennessee State Planning Office. I came later to learn that Tennessee was once a leader among the states when it comes to community planning. The law which enables cities and counties to have planning commissions was a model statute used by other states. Unfortunately, the State Planning Office was abolished in the early days of the Haslam administration about 7 years ago. So we have gone from being a progressive model to a state where at best the state government is ambivalent about planning and at worst adversarial to it. And so I thought it would be good to sit down with Bill and get some sort of report on the status of community planning in Tennessee. So I hope you'll enjoy my conversation with Bill Terry. Welcome, Bill Terry, to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Great to have you.
Well, it's nice to be here. I'm kind of surprised and don't know really what to do yet, but here I am.
Well, we'll just have a conversation here at the kitchen table and just talk as friends. How about that?
Good deal.
All right. You and I have known each other a good many years, going back to when you were working for the Tennessee State Planning Office. Tell our listeners about yourself and about your background.
Okay. Started out in planning completely by accident. Didn't know what planning was, just like a lot of people, until I went to work as a trainee planner in what became the Tennessee State Planning Office. And after... I don't know, a couple of 3 years as something of a trainee planner, I got promoted and started providing planning assistance to local governments that took out contracts with the state. And I worked with communities all over the mid-state, ranging in size from, say, the town of Monterey, the town of Waverly, all the way up to Gallatin and Sumner County. That was my experience with the state, and that lasted for a good many years.
So educationally, what was your preparation for getting to work for state government?
Well, the usual preparation is to get a master's degree in planning,
right,
which I did not have. Right. I started off with my bachelor's degree, and then I realized pretty soon that wasn't enough, and so I went back and picked up a master's degree in political science and public administration. Okay. At the time that I was doing all that, there were very few planning schools, the closest ones being Georgia Tech and the University of North Carolina.
Okay.
And later on in life, the University of Tennessee set up one.
I remember that.
And then the University of Memphis set up one. Okay. The University of Memphis is still operating a planning school.
Okay.
UT's went out of business.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, several years ago.
Okay.
So I worked in... in the State Planning Office, Local Planning Assistance Program, for the those many years. And then I resigned and went to work for the city of Goodlettsville as their planning director. Okay. And I worked there for 15 years. And eventually decided that I was going to do something else. And so I retired because I had enough years in the state system. and became what I call a consultant.
Okay.
Just like a lot of other people.
Terrific.
And I've done a variety of different things as a consultant.
Now, I know that you are involved with an organization, which is the Tennessee chapter of the American Planning Association. Mm-hmm. I believe you're the lobbyist for that organization.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many years have you been doing that?
I've been lobbying for the Planning Association since 2004.
Okay.
When I retired from Goodlettsville.
I see.
And I first started doing it as just a volunteer, and then they decided they'd start paying me, and so I registered and all that kind of stuff. And so I have done that for several years. It's not a lucrative job, of course, because this is a nonprofit association.
Right.
Doesn't have any money.
Right.
But I have done that because there's no one else to do it in the Nashville area.
Right.
And everybody,
it can be time-consuming.
It's very time-consuming, yeah. And due to the nature of planning, particularly zoning, we have to monitor state legislation very closely, and we have to monitor what the legislature introduces very closely, what legislators file every year. And so that's one thing that I do.
Well, Bill, you and I go way back, and I remember meeting you when you worked for the state planning office. I remember that distinctly, going out to the office over there on Trousdale and
really
making a talk to the bunch of your planners about local park and recreation interests.
I had forgotten about all that. I remember meeting you when I was concerned about the land encroachments around Radnor Lake.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And I asked, it was back at the time when you could just call the commissioner's office and get an appointment. So I called Charlie Howell's office to get an appointment to meet with him and see what could be done about getting more land protected at Radnor, and you were there.
Okay. I remember that. I remember that. It's remarkable. I do remember the, not that particular meeting, but certainly the issue of the development that was planned up around the Dyer Observatory.
Yeah.
And I remember actually, as you just described, calling, and I called up and made a meeting with the guy that was the director of planning for the city of Nashville, metropolitan government at the time, whose name I'll not remember. And I presented to him, I was the director of state parks at the time, and I presented to him the issue of development next to the park, and it was like talking to someone that really didn't understand English or the problem. He had no concept that they could be part of assistance to in making protecting that property there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that situation's any better in Nashville now, but as it happens, the city, well, the state, and with the cooperation of others, have acquired property out there.
Yeah, it was shortly thereafter when, of course, the reason that I'm called Charlie Howell, number one, I knew him kind of casually.
Right.
And we wanted to see if there was any program that the state had to acquire any more land. Of course, he said no, they didn't have any money.
Right.
And so shortly thereafter is when a group of us got together over some adult beverages and talked about forming Friends of Radnor Lake.
Exactly.
And that's
been a quite
successful. That's how that came about, too.
An unbelievably successful organization.
Yes, it is.
Let's jump back a second and tell our listeners, you know, what do planning commissions do? Maybe even before that, I think Tennessee historically, the state law that enables cities and counties to have planning commissions was one of the first in model legislations.
Well, actually, the planning movement started a long time ago.
Okay.
Planning cities is nothing new. They've been doing it since ancient Greece.
Right.
Did Alexandria as a planned city at that time. You go to English cities, and they were laid out in certain ways, and that concept was brought over here when this country was settled. And so early cities like Charleston and Savannah and New Haven, Connecticut and Philadelphia, all were laid out and designed a certain way. So those cities were planned. Now, the concept of a planning profession itself came about in the 1890s and started out that way, coming out of the white city plans of the Chicago World's Fair of 1892 or 3. And that kind of started the movement. And then in the early 1900s, it accelerated, and the problems that were tried to be solved at that time were related to incompatible land uses being located next to each other.
Okay.
And this occurred in California and some of the cities out there, Los Angeles, where Los Angeles was going rapidly, and one thing that they wanted to accomplish was to keep industrial uses out of residential areas. So they did something on that line. But the first comprehensive zoning ordinance in the country was adopted in New York City in 1916. And the reason for that zoning ordinance being compiled and the way that it did was because of, again, of incompatible land uses. The garment industry in New York City was being located downtown near to the very expensive retail shops that they had down there. And so the retail industry wanted to keep the hard industry out. And so that's how the zoning ordinance came about, and that's how zoning started.
Just from incompatible uses, mm-hmm. And then...
First planning commissions in Tennessee were done by private act in the 1920s.
This was before the general enabling legislation.
Right.
The cities and counties had to go to state government.
State government had to give them the right to do this, because local government... All the authority, particularly police power authority for regulation, lies with the state.
Right.
And so the state has to give that authority to local governments. And that's what started in 1920s. In 1935, our general legislation was adopted by the legislature. And it came about, it was a national movement, of course, but the Tennessee legislation came about because of TVA.
Tell us more.
TVA was formed, of course, by the Roosevelt administration in 1932 or 3. And as a part of their program, they were set up, of course, to generate power and build dams to do that with. But they were also set up for economic development purposes, because Tennessee was a very backward, poor state. Never had recovered from the Civil War fully, I don't think. But in any case, TVA thought that it would be a good idea if there was some statewide planning involved along with them, because they were planning things around their reservoirs. And so they hired a land use lawyer out of Cincinnati by the name of Alfred Bettman.
Okay. Well, that's news to me. I grew up in Cincinnati, but never knew that name.
He drafted the Tennessee legislation.
I didn't know that. That's
which was ultimately passed in 1935. And it created at that time what was called the Tennessee State Planning Commission.
Right.
And it was set up in that way, to do statewide planning and to help local governments set up their own local planning programs.
Right.
And it started in the late 1930s, and you might be interested in this, looking at state parks. The State Planning Commission did a report in about 1935 or so, 36, right after that, studying statewide resources, coupled with TVA's resource plan, and that led to the state park system.
Yes, exactly.
What was it, Organic Act of 1937 for state parks?
You know, I think that there was, the issue of incompatible uses, a pig farm being next to a hospital, that sort of thing, is an issue in planning. There's also the issue of allocation of resources. We only have so much money to build schools and so much money to build water plants and sewer plants. And so those things have to be located in the most appropriate places. so that we don't waste money building those facilities that where we don't need them or don't mm-hmm. or can't utilize them.
One thing that we're experiencing in this rapid growth of the mid-state area now is the results of what we might call the type of planning that was done after World War II and going on into the 60s and 70s, where subdivisions and houses were developed, but the roadway system did not necessarily accommodate, wasn't designed to accommodate all that traffic, and it's still not.
Right.
So even though we had an interstate highway system built, development occurring all throughout the mid-state area and other parts of the country as well, was far ahead of the capacity issue. You got to have capacity for traffic, you got to have capacity for generating clean water, and you have to have sewer capacity.
Right.
And all of those things work together in a planning program.
So the Tennessee State Planning Office, created back in the 30s, it existed. The state planning office existed until the early days of the Alexander administration, is my recollection.
And a little beyond.
Maybe, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I do remember that those folks were involved with us in conservation, with the Department of Education, with the Department of Transportation, mm-hmm. trying to coordinate the capital budgets of each of those agencies to make sure that we're not wasting money here or when we could be spending it there and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And alongside that, there was the local planning division, as you described, we had a cadre of planners who would make themselves available to cities and counties to help them with their planning.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we did.
I don't know whether I ever traveled with you out to any of your cities, but I did travel with some of your colleagues.
No, you didn't travel with me. I would have remembered.
You probably would have remembered. I would have probably remembered. I do remember traveling with Greer Bermel and some others.
Really?
To some of her clients. This particular agency, the Tennessee State Planning Office, now doesn't exist anymore.
That's correct. There have been a number of changes through the years, as you would expect, I guess, but I think it has not been necessarily good for cities and counties, the changes that occurred. We had initially the Tennessee State Planning Commission, which was reorganized out of business in, I think it was about 1972 or so, and there was a big reorganization act that was passed that year, and so the State Planning Commission went away. The organization is known as the three parts of the State Planning Office, which was State Planning Office, Local Planning Office, and Research.
Okay.
Were transferred into an overall State Planning Office. The commission was replaced by what's known as the Local Government Planning Advisory Committee.
Okay.
Which is given certain duties by state law. And so that committee still exists today. But the State Planning Office itself was done away with by the Sundquist administration in 1998. The Local Planning Office was transferred out of state planning prior to that to the Department of Economic and Community Development, and where it lived until Governor Haslam came in 2012. He did away with the program entirely.
Okay. I think that's, I really think that's tragic, and I would love to hear your take on that.
Well, I fought it as a planner as the lobbyist for the Planning Association, but it was, by the time it was announced that they were going to do away with the office and all the planners were basically fired, laid off. It had gone so far that one of the legislators, which I thought might help, he's a very powerful legislator, said that Haslam was too far into it and it was too far gone and he couldn't stop it.
So what's been the effect of that on the landscape?
It affected small communities and counties governments. The larger cities such as Hendersonville, Gallatin, Murfreesboro, Franklin, they all have their own staff now.
Right.
All of them initially started out using the local planning assistance program, every one of those cities. And when they grew to a certain size, and this is typical, and the size probably being in the neighborhood of 10 to 12 to 15,000 population, then they have enough going on to hire their own staff.
Right.
So by the time the 2012 rolls around and they do away with the office is working primarily with small towns and counties, such as Manchester and Menville, and
right.
all of those kinds of places.
What
and
are they
so
doing
they
now?
They don't have that planning service anymore now. Some of the planning services that the local planning office provided are now provided by development districts.
Okay.
So they're doing the same type thing, but the problem with that was the cost went up. The state wasn't subsidizing it anymore. And so the development districts had to charge more, and some governments fell out of the program. They don't have any assistance at all.
Okay.
For example, I mentioned Manchester. I went to Manchester about 3 or 4 years ago and did a planning commissioner training session. One of the laws that applies to us now is that all planning commission members have to have 4 hours of training a year. And so I do those from time to time when I get asked. And so I went to Manchester and did their training program for their planning commission, and I asked them how they were getting along without planning services, and said, well, they don't have any.
Gracious.
They're the building inspector who enforces their building code.
Right.
Also advises the planning commission. Of course, he's not a planner by any means. But anyway, so they're doing without the services. And what's the long-term effect of that? Who knows?
Yeah, I can remember traveling to Manchester. I don't know whether it was Greer, Brummel, or there was a young black man, Art.
Art Brown.
Art Brown. It may have been Art that I went down there with. But they were concerned. The city at the time was desiring to have more city parks and to hire a park and recreation director.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not have known that as the person in state government whose job it was to do that, to help with that, if it were not for the person there in the state planning office who was there more often and interacted mm-hmm. with those people more often. And now they do have a good local park and recreation program down there.
That's a pretty good one.
So those planners facilitated assistance to those communities from the other state agencies.
Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, in those small communities, the planner that went to those meetings on a regular basis and probably went down to meet with the city government or the county government in between meetings was the only professional type presence in those cities.
Exactly, and of course they would help the city write a grant application if necessary, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing for not only parks but for sewer plants and for lots of those things that they might need.
Yeah.
So now you're involved with the planning association and as their legislative representative, as their lobbyist. We've got the second part of the legislative session coming into a meeting here in the next month or so. What do you anticipate being on the agenda that you're going to be watching out for in the legislature this year?
Well, first off, you never know what's going to be dropped in. And there were several bills that were part of the first session of this General Assembly. Even East General Assembly is just a two-year program. So we're in the 1/10th General Assembly now, and the first part of that has ended and starts again in January.
So there's some carryovers.
Yeah, all the bills that were in the legislative hopper in February, March, and April of this year that did not pass or fail, they never came up for a vote, they get deferred in all kinds of reasons, they can be brought back up in January.
Okay.
And as well, there will be new bills introduced. I've forgotten exactly how many bills were introduced for the first session of the 1/10th General Assembly, but I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000. And there might be another 2,000 dropped in starting about right now.
Right. So what's left over from last session? That may have already passed one of the houses of the legislature, maybe up for consideration still.
Well, when you start talking about specific bills, you start getting real specific as to how it affects a certain area of the Tennessee Code. It might just affect one sentence.
Right.
Maybe it'd be a drafted bill to do this, that, and so it might change just one idea in the code, and it has monumental effect. For example, there was a bill filed to change the way that cities and counties have to publicize their meetings on a zoning change for rezoning some property. The current requirement, it's been in the law for years and years and years, is that there must be a public notice in a newspaper of general circulation 15 days before the public hearing that occurs at the legislative body.
Okay.
That's what's required by the law.
Legislative body, you're referring to the city council?
City council, yeah. Board of Aldermen, yeah. Right. county commission, those things.
Right.
And that wasn't there because zoning changes. Property does get rezoned from time to time, and there is a requirement for the publication. There is no requirement for direct public notice. And so that's what was being required. Now, because most people today don't really read a newspaper, don't look for public notices, it's difficult to really notify the public that this is going on. And so what cities and counties have done is changed. Even though they're not required to by law, they post signs on property, which is very good, and they send out a first-class letter to different areas. They might send out a first-class letter to adjoining pieces of property for one that is being proposed for rezoning, or they might send out the first-class letter to property owners within 1,000 feet or a half mile or something like that. And so that's what's being done, but by law they only have to do that publication. And so what has happened in two or three cases was that a piece of property got rezoned without the owner knowing about it, claiming that they did not get a notice.
The actual owner of the property?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so when that happens, we get a bill, not a legislature. And the bill this last year would have required all local governments to notify property owners by certified return mail.
Okay.
That increases the cost enormously to local governments because each letter costs about $6.50.
Exactly.
And so that's the example of one change. Now that has not passed, but it's still hanging around in the legislature.
Right.
And the reason it didn't pass is because the intent of the bill was to be sure that property owners were notified. Nothing wrong with that at all. I agree
exactly.
with it.
Exactly.
But the effect of it would have been that when you change the wording in a zoning ordinance, a text amendment as opposed to changing a zone on the map, that affects the entire community, potentially. And so some communities had calculated how much it would cost them to notify all the property owners. You got thousands of property owners to notify, and it was up into hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Sure.
So that bill has not passed. It's probably will be reworked in some way, but that's an example of what we deal with. And then the issue of short-term rental properties that we talk about so much here in Nashville, that bill to prohibit Nashville from regulating short-term rentals, from non-owner occupied short-term rentals.
This is a really hot issue here in Nashville.
Has passed the House, and it would prohibit just the city of Nashville. And I say
so this
city.
This is the Airbnb.
Airbnb
phenomenon.
Yeah, it would prohibit Nashville and Davidson County from zoning out the non-owner occupied short-term rental property from a residential neighborhood. It would only prohibit Nashville, though. It would not prohibit all the rest of the state.
So
that's
Let's get another issue. Let's get behind that a minute. And I know very well that the city councilmen here in Nashville are working diligently to try to find some solution to the regulation of these rentals. It's a problem because neighbors complain that these places become party houses and that sort of thing.
And they do.
Sometimes,
not all of them.
But it happens, and police get called, and people get rowdy, and that sort of thing. So there's every incentive for local government here to work out a solution that people, the landowners can live with, and that the community can live with. So why does the legislature feel a necessity to involve themselves?
Well, go back to the issue of state authority. The state passes the law that authorizes local governments to have a planning commission. It authorizes them to adopt subdivision standards and regulation. It also authorizes them to adopt a zoning ordinance and enforce the zoning ordinance. The idea of zoning out a short-term rental property is something that many communities were looking at. And some communities across the state
just prohibiting it altogether.
Yeah, some prohibit them altogether.
Okay.
And some cities have decided they're not all that bad, and so they're going to allow them to operate under certain conditions.
Okay.
They regulate them, but they hadn't zoned them out. Some cities have zoned them out. Brentwood.
All right.
Zoned them out.
Okay.
And Forest Hills, Oak Hill, Belle Mead, here in Davidson County, I think they all have adopted ordinances that do not allow non-owner-occupied short-term rentals.
Okay.
Nashville can't do that. But the state gets involved to restrict local government's authority on some of these issues because of complaints from land developers, different professional associations, chambers of commerce. They all get involved in these issues, and so they get tangled up in the legislature, which is the reason that I go down there, because there's no one else that goes down there to represent planning other than you've got the Municipal League and the County Services Association, but they deal with all kinds of issues, and I look specifically at planning and zoning.
So if you look at, this is a question, because I certainly don't know anything about how the business of these short-term rentals operate. But when we go to the beach, we get a short-term rental of a home that somebody else owns that they don't live in. A beach community is one thing. They are built more or less for vacationers.
Yeah, that's what we do. We have utilized VRBO, which is it's another organization like Airbnb. We think it's a better organization, but that's just personal opinion. But we have utilized VRBO to rent properties for vacation. But like you say, they're in a resort community. They're in a place that's designed for transient people to come in and leave. We stayed in several like that. But don't stay in a normal residential neighborhood.
Right.
And which is what is happening here in Nashville so much, is all these properties have opened up in single-family residential neighborhoods.
Well,
and so that's where the issue
is. Yes, I have friends that have purchased homes and kind of reworked them just for that purpose as an investment.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think? What's the future in that? Can you predict where that's headed?
I can't predict where it's headed.
Okay.
Because I found the legislature to be many times totally unpredictable. I'm not being derogatory. That's just the way they work. You got different people from all parts of the state.
Right.
The issues vary from large cities to small counties, which we have here, and the small counties have representatives too, and they have completely different issues. In most cases, they also have planning commissions. Now, the issues that a planning commission would deal with in a small West Tennessee county is going to be completely different than what they deal with in Williamson County. They're probably looking more at trying to encourage development of any kind and get, quote, new industries, what they've always right. talked about, although that term doesn't really work anymore. They're trying to get that into their communities. And here, we're trying for more broad-based economic development.
You know, Bill, I can remember when the, you know, the census was taken in 1979-80. And I remember when the first results of that census in Tennessee were released. You may remember this. Being impressed by the fact that in 1980-81 revealed that we, for the first time since the Civil War, we had a net in-migration of people to Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
So the trend up until the 70s was for people to leave Tennessee to go somewhere else. And that is when the trend reversed and our growth really started. Now that, it was certainly not a statewide phenomenon. We certainly have communities that are not growing. The planners used to be, as you just described, about the business of trying to help these communities find manufacturing jobs and get ready for those and for other industry. What's the job of the planner now with all this development just coming in?
Again, it varies from place to place, but let's look at Nashville and just the mid-state area. And many of the communities here, cities and counties, have their own staff.
Right.
Gallatin has its own staff. Hendersonville has its own staff. Sumner County has its own staff, et cetera. And, most of the time, the planners are engaged in the day-to-day activity of enforcing their regulations because there's so much development going on. And when I say enforcing regulations, I'm talking about both subdivision regulation and a zoning ordinance. Subdivision regulation deal with development and the platting of land.
So if you have 100 dedication acres of streets, land and you want to build 50 houses or 100 houses, then you have to have that plat approved. How do you divide it up?
Planning Commission, that's one of the major jobs of the Planning Commission, is to review and approve subdivision plats.
And what would a subdivision plat include?
Well, you got a two-step process there in most cases, preliminary plat and a final plat. A preliminary plat would show the complete lot arrangement, street layout, and design of a, say, 100-acre tract of land. And so that would go through the review process to see whether or not the proposed plan for that subdivision is in agreement with the adopted subdivision regulations, because the Planning Commission also adopts, generally with staff development, the regulations that govern subdivisions.
Those plans would include where the water lines,
yes,
sewer lines are going to be,
yes,
all that stuff.
Yeah, the preliminary plat would show the general location of all that. That's the first step.
Okay.
Now, in most cases, that 100 acres will be broken up into phases, phase 1, 2, and 3. And that's the final plat.
I got it.
And that's the recording document.
Okay.
After the final plat is approved, which shows the detail, the exact bearings and surveys of the lot, the exact locations of streets, the exact size and location of the water line, sewer line, etc. It shows that in great detail, and it's the recording document that once it's approved, it's recorded in the office of the county register, and then they can sell lots.
Right. Before that, they really can't. They can't sell the lots.
No.
Okay. Because they're not really approved as being lots.
Yeah. So that's one aspect of a planning commission's job. Of course, the other one is making recommendations on zoning. The legislative body, again, is the official body for the city or the county, the elected officials. They adopt the zoning regulations. Planning Commission recommends the zoning regulations. So there's a difference there.
Right.
And since most communities have had zoning for years, now it's all involved in rezoning.
Right.
zoning making, changes.
Making changes, yeah. Right.
So that's, then make it a change in zoning, it has to start with the Planning Commission. And the Planning Commission will make a recommendation one way or the other to the City Council, County Commission, about their recommendation, and then it goes for a final vote at the legislative level. Here in Metro, that goes for three readings before the City Council.
Right. You know, my observation as having lived in Nashville for 30, 40 years is that it used to be very easy to get zoning change, especially if you were a developer with the means and readiness to invest in the city.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you were ready to spend several million dollars on a development, they were ready to take your money and make the necessary zoning change.
Yeah.
Is that climate changing in any way, or is
that attitude probably still exists in lots of places? If somebody wants to do something that the town thinks is progressive and would help their economy, would help them grow, then yeah, they'll approve it.
Right.
But in the last 10-15 years particularly, that has changed somewhat because so many things have happened that upset the next door neighbor or upset the next door subdivision. And so neighborhood groups have gotten involved in the process. At one time, they were totally absent. But now it's almost universal that you have a neighborhood group that's going to be involved in some way in either the negotiation for a development or for either standing in support or in opposition right. to a change.
Right. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
And so that is I think it's a good thing. But it does affect the planning program.
You know, and if you over the course of 5 or 6 years approve several changes along those lines, and all of a sudden now you have built 1,500 or 2,000 homes, well, maybe now you have a need for a new school.
Mm-hmm.
How does that figure in? The taxpayers now are on the hook for having to build a new school.
Well, as you know, school boards are separate and independent. And the Planning Commission is over here, the school board's over here.
Right.
And there's, you know, if they have, the third major thing that the Planning Commission should be doing, and in many cases are doing, is developing a long-range plan for the city or the county. And in that long-range plan, school location would be a part of it.
Okay.
That when a certain amount of growth occurs in an area, then we need to have a location for the school at an appropriate place.
Right.
And so that is done. And many times the school boards and the planning commissions work together.
Right.
The staff of the planning commission go over and meet with the school board. See, okay, we're going to have a school site. Is this one compatible with school board policies and stuff? And so that's how you work that out in many cases, although the school board has the final say.
Of where the schools are.
Well, the school's going to locate, yeah. And how the area around it is going to be involved in the school. This involves the taxpayers because, we'll go down to Williamson County, they're building almost one school a year for $1.5 million or so. And so they're looking at, right now, they're looking at a referendum on a sales tax increase for Williamson County. And typical way of financing that school is when the school is built, the school board is authorized to the school, the county commission appropriates the money for the school, and it is built. They sell bonds, and so you got to pay those bonds back over time. And that's what the tax rate is set to do, is to pay back the bond. So it's either property tax or sales tax. And you have to. Otherwise, you don't build a school. You just look.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so it's kind of a catch-22 for the government, because in all these rapidly growing counties, population comes in, kids come in, you got to build a school.
Right. The developers, per se, are not participating in the cost of building those schools?
Not in many ways. Now, in some cases, depending on the development, a very large development, the developer may set aside a piece of property for the school and actually donate it to the county or the school board.
Okay.
So that does happen. And in other cases, they'll reserve the property for the school, but the county will have to buy it.
Right. Gotcha.
But it is included in the plan of the development for having a school site.
Let's change horses just here a second. And I think, you know, from looking at Tennessee on a statewide basis, the protection of natural resources, prime farmland, forested areas, places that would be logically parks or natural areas. What's happening these days in planning along those lines?
Oh, a lot. People move into an area and there's a nice farm across the street or a forest of some kind, and they want to see it stay that way. Unfortunately, the only way you can guarantee that that farm or that open space is going to stay that way is to buy it. In this country, landowners have a right to develop the land if they want to. The right to sell the land and then have the right to develop it, right, as long as you meet the local regulations.
Otherwise, it's considered to be a taking.
Right.
It's
a regulatory taking.
That prohibits any development is essentially taking it.
So you have to recognize that at some point in time, that farm may be a subdivision. So if you've lost two things there. You've lost the view for the neighbors that were already there. You've also lost the productive capacity of the farmland if it's been actively farmed. And particularly when it comes to prime farmland soil, they're not making any more of that stuff.
Exactly.
It ought to be preserved for that purpose, for growing food. But another tenet of that is that local zoning cannot protect open space like that. You cannot zone a piece of property for open space because then you've taken it.
Exactly. You're saying that there's no use.
So the regulations can be formulated in such a way that the developer sets aside a certain amount of that property as permanent open space and either makes it as a part of a homeowners association or in some cases donates it to a land trust. The Land Trust of Tennessee has done some good work in preserving tracts of land.
With conservation easements,
sometimes with actually a fee simple acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the ways that open space can be preserved. There's such a thing as a conservation subdivision that in areas that want to do this type of preservation. You adopt regulations that allow a developer to cluster the houses on smaller lots in a certain area of the development, and then the remainder of the development is preserved permanently as open space.
Right.
That's one way of doing it, and it works pretty well in many cases.
That's what I've observed in France and in Germany is mm-hmm. the way those communities have developed. They really cluster the residential areas close together, mm-hmm. leaving the farmland available.
There's a big issue here in Nashville, of course, with what we call tall skinnies.
Yes.
And zoning regulations in Nashville were developed many years ago, but when they developed, they allowed in some zoning districts single and two-family dwellings, the duplexes.
Duplexes.
And over time, that concept of a duplex, two living units under a single roof, changed. And so rather than having two units under a single roof, you could put two units on the lot. So what is happening now?
Two freestanding
units.
Yeah.
So what is happening now all over this area is that an old house that was built in the 1930s or 40s or even 60s being torn down. Nothing wrong with it, it's just being torn down. And then two houses put on that lot.
Right.
And so that's where the tall skinnies come in. And if you go anywhere around Green Hills, you can see them everywhere because this area was zoned, I think, something like R10 or R12, that was the 10,000 square foot lot and it allowed two units on it. Well, it's a fairly small lot in the first place, so you're going to put two units on it, and they're going to have to be tall and skinny.
Exactly.
Now, that upsets a lot of people because they don't like them. They've increased the density. You've actually doubled the density of that neighborhood. Density being how many units are allowed and how many people will live there.
Sure.
So you double the units. At some point in time, you have to look at capacity of the water lines that are in the ground.
And sewer lines.
In the ground.
Exactly.
And the traffic carrying capacity of the streets.
Right.
But another thing that it does, by concentrating development in areas like this with more units allowed on the lot, you might be able to preserve some open space somewhere else.
That's the theory. Boy, I hope that theory
works. That's a theory.
Hope that theory works.
And if X number of people are going to locate in an area and you can locate most of them in a dense environment like that,
right,
then they won't locate out here on the greenfield.
Sure. I mean, these neighborhoods and this part of Nashville were built before the sewer lines came out this far.
Yeah.
So they had to be built on acre lots, acre and a half lots.
Which is what I have. I have an acre lot, which was on a septic tank.
Just to accommodate a septic tank.
Now it's on a sewer.
Sewers are expensive to build. Yeah. Terribly expensive. And sewer plants.
And maintain.
To get the best value out of them, the more people you have them tied into them, as long as it's not too many,
mm-hmm,
the better.
An 8-inch sewer line has a certain capacity.
Right,
but you don't want to.
You don't want to exceed that. I find it interesting in Nashville. We're having to go back in and replace what were combination sewer lines, sewer and septic sewer, and that's expensive, but all for the better. Well, Bill, it's been a joy to have you here and talk with you. We've gone for about 50 minutes now, and it goes pretty quickly.
Yeah, it has.
I sure congratulate you on the things that you do. I know you're involved in so many organizations, the Sierra Club and Audubon and all these organizations. You're the Conservation Voters. I know that you're involved in these, and I congratulate you for all you do. Thank you for coming in.
I appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.